KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Investigators hope the cockpit voice and flight data recorders from the passenger jet that crashed into a military helicopter Wednesday night will help them piece together what led to the crash. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Senators in both parties threw hard questions at Tulsi Gabbard, President Trump's pick for Director of National Intelligence. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We'll ask Arizona Senator Mark Kelly about some of the concerns over her nomination. Plus, activists call for a boycott of Target over a rollback of DEI initiatives. We hear from a black business owner who says it would hurt her more than Target. It is Friday, January 31st. On this day in 1988, Doug Williams of the Washington Redskins, now the Commanders, became the first African-American quarterback to play in a Super Bowl. And news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. As crews continue to search the Potomac River for victims of Wednesday's mid-air collision between an American Airlines regional jet and a military helicopter near Washington, D.C., the National Transportation Safety Board has retrieved the flight data and voice recorders from the plane. Todd Inman is a member of the board.
We will be on scene here doing all the recovery of the perishable evidence that we need for as long as it takes.
He says investigators are still collecting evidence as crews work to salvage the aircraft that broke into three pieces and is in waist-deep water. 67 people died in the crash. So far, more than two dozen bodies have been recovered. Meanwhile, the figure skating community is grieving the loss of young skaters, coaches, and families who died. And here's Kristen Wright has more.
As stories emerge of the hopes and dreams of these young skaters, the world of figure skating is still in disbelief. Aurora Michelle coaches in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, and remembers practicing with a boy who was on the plane.
I feel heartbroken because there are so many young lives that were lost. So many promising young lives that were lost.
Michelle placed flowers at Ashburn Ice House in Northern Virginia at a growing memorial for the rink's skaters and a coach who died. She says the skating community is very close.
And so when someone in our community is hurting, it affects all of us.
School officials in Virginia's Fairfax County say three of their students and six parents were also on board. The superintendent is asking people to hold each other closer. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
As a candidate, Donald Trump disavowed Project 2025, the controversial policy agenda. But NPR's Franco Ordonez reports many of the directives he's issued as president come from the 900-page playbook.
The proposed freeze on federal grants was just the latest directive by President Trump that was outlined in Project 2025. So is a proposal to end birthright citizenship and diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Project 2025 also offered detailed plans to reshape and shrink the federal workforce, including instituting a hiring freeze and reclassifying workers. Now, critics see Project 2025 as a roadmap of how Trump is trying to expand his presidential powers. And Democratic senators are pointing to the playbook as justification for trying to block Trump's pick for White House budget director, Russ Vogt. But the White House and allies discount any overlap, charging that Trump is simply carrying out promises that he made on the campaign trail. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
And President Trump says he's planning to place 25% tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico as soon as tomorrow. That could drive up the price of everything from pickup trucks to guacamole dip. Trump, though, says he hasn't decided yet if the tariffs will include oil imports. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In South Africa, there has been widespread confusion after President Trump froze, then unfroze, millions of dollars in funding for life-saving HIV programs. Kate Bartlett has more from Johannesburg.
South Africa's health minister, Aaron Motsoaledi, said his country was blindsided by President Trump's initial order to freeze aid for 90 days. The minister said he sought clarity from the U.S. embassy but received no response. South Africa has the highest number of HIV-positive people in the world, with nearly 6 million on antiretroviral therapies. It receives about $400 million a year from the U.S. through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. Motsoaledi said his government only found out about the freeze through clinics and other organizations that had received orders to stop work. Mazzoletti said things were still unclear after the State Department did a sudden about-turn, issuing a waiver. Globally, PEPFAR directly supports more than 20 million people living with HIV. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
NPR has learned the director of the Census Bureau, Robert Santos, is resigning, giving President Trump an early opportunity to nominate a new political appointee to lead the agency. Before becoming director, Santos, the first Latino in the job, was a vocal opponent of the way Trump officials handled the 2020 census. He's cutting short a five-year appointment during key preparations for the 2030 census that will be used to redistribute political representation, along with trillions of dollars in federal funding across the country. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, we'll hear from Democratic U.S. Senator Mark Kelly. He has reservations about Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's pick for National Intelligence Director. But first, federal investigators have retrieved the cockpit voice and flight data recorders from the American Airlines jet that collided with an Army helicopter Wednesday night.
The crash, which occurred over the Potomac River, killed 67 people. We're also beginning to learn the identities of some of the crew on those aircraft.
NPR's Frank Langfitt has been following this story. Frank, so what will investigators be hoping to find out from the black boxes of that regional jet?
Yeah, I think the final conversations in the cockpit, obviously before the two aircraft collided, they'll also be able to see about the plane's performance, data points, and including, and I think this is really important, the altitude of the plane leading up to and at the time of the collision. It's not yet clear how these two aircraft, who are supposed, of course, to pass at a safe distance, how they ended up in the same place at the same time. Of course, also are going to need the Army Black Hawk black box to be able to compare. And a question that's really coming up, I think, particularly yesterday, talking to people at the NTSB, is, was that helicopter on the right flight path? The Black Hawk's recorder, as far as we know right now, is still in the river, but the National Transportation Safety Board, they're very confident they'll retrieve it.
Okay. What do we know about the crew of the American Airlines jet?
Yeah, we've got some confirmations here. The pilot was Jonathan Campos. He was 34. The first officer, a man named Sam Lilly in his late 20s, both based in Charlotte, really avid flyers. And Lilly is a second-generation pilot. His father, Tim, used to fly for Air Wisconsin. And writing on Facebook yesterday, Tim Lilly wrote that Sam's career had been going very well, and he was engaged to be married in the fall. And he wrote this. He said, "Now it hurts so bad, I can't even cry myself to sleep." Now, later today, we should learn the identities of the three service members who were crewing the Black Hawk.
Okay. Frank, there are reports that the Federal Aviation Administration has said that the controller handling helicopters was also instructing planes. And that's a job normally done by two people. So did federal investigators have anything to say about that?
Yeah, this was an FAA report that's been quoted by a number of news sources. NTSB, this is one of the board members, a guy named Todd Inman spoke yesterday, and he said they had not reviewed any specific reports about the controllers, but said, of course, as a matter of course, you know, you're going to be looking at what was going on in the control room and with the controllers. This is what he said.
Our investigators are continuing to pull all that information, their personnel records, their files, where they were at, whether they were fatigued. All that information will be part of that investigative process.
And you know, A, that's not ideal, but analysts say it's also not unusual and not necessarily dangerous, depending on how much traffic is going on at the time.
All right, so today, another day of searching. What are people hoping to find out today?
Yeah, I mean, just more information. You know, the NTSB yesterday down at Reagan National, you know, during the press conference, they didn't say very much. And they're planning another briefing today. And typically, it's the second day where you learn a bit more. You know, yesterday was just the first day the team was on the ground. And I'm actually looking at photos right now of NTSB workers opening up those black boxes from the airliner. And federal investigators, what they're really emphasizing is they want to be really careful about confirming facts before they pass them on. And there should be a preliminary report on this accident. It should be completed in about 30 days.
30 days. Okay. That's NPR's Frank Langford. Frank, thank you.
Good to talk, eh?
Not far from where rescue crews were working at the wreckage site, senators on Capitol Hill were holding confirmation hearings for several of President Trump's cabinet picks. They were contentious. Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's choice for director of national intelligence, was one of the nominees who faced tough questions from members of both parties on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Here's an exchange with Democratic Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado at yesterday's hearing.
I understand how critical our national security
is. Apparently you don't. Apparently you don't.
Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, also a Democrat, also participated in that hearing, and he's with us now to tell us more of his thoughts. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Michelle.
So let me explain a little bit about what the Director of National Intelligence does. He or she is supposed to be the leader of the intelligence community. They're supposed to coordinate the intelligence across agencies so they can present a coherent picture to the president. Basically, that person is the person's main advisor on intelligence. What's your main reservation about Tulsi Gabbard serving in that role?
Well, whether or not she's prepared to do it, you mentioned these agencies. There's 18 of them, including the CIA, the National Security Agency, and others. And it's about whether you have the background to do this, but also having the right judgment and ability to make some really hard decisions every single day to make sure the president has the intelligence that he needs to protect our country. And so my big concerns with Colonel Gabbard is, you know, that she's contradicted our own intelligence community on Assad's use of chemical weapons against his own people. And then she also has this propensity to use information as if it's true when it comes from, you know, dictators like Putin and Assad in Syria. And that's going to result in us being, all of us being less safe.
So you mentioned Colonel Gabbard. She's a former officer in the Army Reserves. She's also a former member of Congress from Hawaii. And when she sat on the House Armed Services and Foreign Affairs Committees, she was skeptical of U.S. intelligence that Syria's former dictator Bashar al-Assad was linked to chemical weapons attacks on civilians in this country. She was relying on a theory espoused by somebody with ties to Assad. Now, you asked her about that during the hearing. What does that whole episode tell you?
Well, it tells me that she, you know, is skeptical, very skeptical. And I think skepticism is actually a healthy thing.
I was going to ask, is that a bad thing to be skeptical?
It's not a bad thing. And it's good to be pushing back, including, you know, on the people that are supporting you and that you work with. But she was much more skeptical of our own intelligence community, despite having a huge number of experts in so many different areas. And she would not apply that same skepticism to information she would get from a single source that wasn't an expert. You mentioned, you know, there were two specific chemical attacks, and she had a so-called expert from MIT who was relying on a chemist who happened to be a chemistry student in Australia that would put videos online that was not an expert. And this individual at MIT didn't have the expertise in sarin gas and other chemical weapons. And so she was, you know, very sympathetic to like these sources and also sympathetic to Assad in this case, and repeating talking points that would come from our adversaries and not trusting anything that the intelligence community put out there on Assad's use of chemical weapons. So that's not the healthy kind of skepticism, and it didn't have the follow-up that you would expect from somebody who's a professional and who wants to lead 18 agencies.
So do you know how you're going to vote?
Yeah, I'm not there on her, and I think she's a patriot. She served our country, you know, for over two decades. She served in Congress, you know, she cares about our nation. I just don't feel she's up to this job.
Do any of your Republican colleagues share your concern about her qualifications and her judgment?
Well, for anybody who watched that hearing we had yesterday, and especially on the issue of Edward Snowden, who stole millions of documents, secrets, and then turned them over to Russia. If you watch those exchanges with my Republican colleagues, you get a strong sense that they're having a very hard time with this nomination.
Okay. So let me turn to immigration. You are among 12 Senate Democrats who voted with Republicans on the Laken Riley Act. It's a new law that requires federal officials to detain undocumented immigrants who are arrested or charged with certain crimes, including shoplifting. On the one hand, the person who killed Laken Riley had been picked up on a charge like that. The argument is he wouldn't have been in a position to kill her if he had been deported. On the other hand, people can be charged who are innocent, and that's one of the things that the critics of this are concerned about. Is this bill good policy, or is it just good politics?
Well, so public safety is very important to me. You know, I'm the son of two police officers. I represent the state of Arizona in the United States Senate. We're a border state. Immigration and border security are very important to me. It's something I work on a lot. I think this is the right bill. Maybe it's not perfect. You know, we tried to amend it a little bit, but when you consider it in its entirety, it's addressing an issue that it's not just about Laken Riley. I mean, it's about individuals that come across the border that already they're committing, you know, one crime, and then they commit another one.
And what if they didn't? What if they're innocent?
Well, then there would be a process. And, you know, after they're found, you know, through a jury trial or charges are dropped, ICE, you know, has the authority to release them.
Before we let you go, you know, when Mitch McConnell was the leader of the Republicans when Obama was president, he said his top priority was depriving him of a second term. He didn't do that. Do the Democrats have a similar philosophy toward this administration? Do you have an overriding priority when it comes to the Trump administration?
Well, Trump's not going to get a third term.
So it couldn't be that, but is there another one?
It's not that. I think it's to figure out where to work with this administration when we can move this country forward. That's a priority of mine. But another priority of mine is when he is acting not in accordance with our principles, longstanding principles as a nation, or not acting in accordance with the law or our ethics, to push back and to prevent bad things from happening. He's got a tendency to throw a lot of stuff out there, you know, that, you know, test the waters on things. And, it's hard for the American people to keep track of. It's hard for me to keep track of. It's my job. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like something new every single day, and it's chaotic. And it's so we're working hard here in Washington, and we're going to continue to do that.
That is Senator Mark Kelly. He's a Democrat from Arizona. Senator Kelly, thanks so much for talking with us. We hope we'll talk again.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
This is NPR News.
After a long hiatus, the critically acclaimed series Severance is back. On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interview with Adam Scott, who stars in the series as a man who chooses to have a chip implanted in his brain designed to separate his work life from his home life. Scott was also in Parks and Recreation, Big Little Lies, and The Good Place. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From EBSCO, committed to upholding the principles of responsible research as they work to develop AI technologies to enhance research around the world. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Reid Hoffman has been thinking about how artificial intelligence can help him think. The co-founder of LinkedIn, the social network for business, has invested in AI for years. I asked him if investors have created an AI bubble over investment, and he said no.
If anything, we're as yet still underinvested and under-rotated towards this kind of new artificial intelligence transformation.
Underinvested? You mean we need a few more trillion dollars thrown in this direction?
We aren't at trillions yet. We are getting there. I think we're just at the very beginning of this really incredible, what I call the cognitive industrial revolution.
Hoffman recorded this last week before the announcement of a cheap Chinese chatbot sent some U.S. tech stocks sliding. In a new book called Super Agency, Hoffman asserts that AI will empower people. He says it will help, in fact, already helps, to sort the infinite amount of information on the internet.
And obviously some of it's very good and some of it's very bad. And so how do we navigate that? How do we figure out which things are accurate? And sometimes it's really important medical information. Sometimes it's important because it's information about what's going on in the world. And sometimes it's, you know, is this going to be a good recipe or a bad recipe for dinner?
The idea is that AI helps me process infinite amounts of information. But it seems to me likely also that AI is going to just keep producing more and more information. The science fiction writer Ted Chiang wrote an interesting article in which he pointed out how likely it is, and I bet it already happens, that some executive is supposed to write a 50-page report. So he gives a few prompts to a large language model, which generates a 50-page report, which gets sent to its recipient, who never reads it. He just has his chatbot boil it back down into bullet points. Like, what is the point of that even?
Well, it's definitely probably happened already and going to happen more. And obviously, if I'm responsible when I'm producing information, I might use an AI assistant to help produce it versus type it out all myself. But I'll read it, refine it, make sure it's very accurate. And then you have both the long form, which is what I'm sending, and then the short form, which I might say, hey, I don't need to look at the long form. All I need to do is see the short form. Hey, I don't have time to read the book Super Agency. I'd really just like to have a 3-page précis. Could you please give me the 3-page précis?
Or a short interview on NPR, just to give another hypothetical situation. But go on, please.
Yes, exactly. But it's a feature, not a bug. What's relevant is, can we find this stuff and engage with the stuff that really matters to our lives and to our work?
Did AI play any role in the writing of this book?
It did. We didn't have AI write the book. We double-checked things. So we'd say, hey, we're writing about what the role of the printing press was or what was happening with cars or mainframes. And then we would go to AI and say, okay, how would a historian of technology think about this? What would their critical analysis would be? Is there anything we missed?
So you hired a fact checker, and the fact checker was a large language model.
Exactly.
Reid Hoffman is like a lot of tech leaders in his enthusiasm for AI. In other ways, he's walked a different path. In 2024, as Elon Musk and others supported Donald Trump, Hoffman backed Kamala Harris. He'd even bankrolled a lawsuit against Trump. And then Trump won. And Hoffman saw many of his tech peers attend the inauguration and sit on stage with the president he opposed.
If I were to pick one industry that I would most want to be in dialogue with the president's office and with the American government, it's the tech industry.
It sounds like you approve of these tech leaders showing up on the inaugural stage, even though you were so politically opposed to this particular president.
Well, you know, in 24, I obviously made a great effort to, you know, what I think, you know, would have been an alternative choice. But part of what I think the responsibility of all citizens, of which I obviously count myself as one, is how do we build the best possible future for Americans? There's obviously going to be things that I have deep questions about, you know, the January 6th pardons, other kinds of things. But building the technological future is, I think, really important. And so you should call out the things that I think are positive.
Critics of Mark Zuckerberg, who I believe is a friend of yours, said a variety of things about Zuckerberg's about face on policy as well as showing up in the inauguration, that he flipped politically, that he bent the knee, that he's blowing with the wind, that he's going for the money. What do you make of those critiques?
Well, you know, I myself have been a voice that I think social networks should, in fact, take a certain social responsibility. I think fact-checking is important.
Which Facebook abandoned, right? Go on.
Yep. And so, you know, I have a different point of view. A lot of that's reflected on LinkedIn, you know, the social network that I co-founded.
Mm-hmm.
The key kind of like meta, you know, question, you know, maybe pun intended here.
well done. Please proceed.
Exactly. What we need to get to as a society is, you know, how do we get good markers for discovering truth?
Do you think Zuckerberg is blowing with the wind?
I think, let's see. I guess what I would say is he's very much trying to build a social infrastructure for the world. He believes very deeply in the freedom of speech. So I don't think he's blowing in the wind in any of those contexts, you know, because I do think that technology companies should be responsive to their governments. Is he being responsive to that? Yes. But, you know, I think that's part of what, as a business leader in any business, you should be doing.
Why did you fall out with Elon Musk?
Well, I think, unfortunately, you know, while I really highly regard Elon's amazing accomplishments in cars and rockets and all the rest, you know, he's been, you know, basically using Twitter to kind of say a bunch of things that are kind of lies and slanders. There's no basis other than maybe competition with AI, maybe, you know, unhappiness about the fact that he made some of the wrong choices around his own involvement in OpenAI. But that's all speculation. All I see is the tweets that have, you know, kind of slanders and lies and no information in them.
There's no personal backstory. It's just his public behavior has turned you off?
Yep. Yep.
Having contributed to Kamala Harris's campaign, having been so outspoken, having bankrolled a lawsuit against President Trump, what are your concerns, if any, about retribution?
Well, my hope is the focus of the administration will be on how do we build as much strength into American society, American industry, as we can versus the various, you know, claims of retribution. I don't think it's that useful to speculate right now. We're in the administration. We will see what happens.
Reid Hoffman, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Have a great day.
His book is Super Agency. This is NPR News.
Since taking office, President Trump has already fired people who prosecuted him.
Are we now going to be in a cycle of every change in administration? There's retribution against those who took positions, you know, you disagreed with.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. More on the upheaval at the Justice Department on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump has implemented sweeping changes since taking office, including wide-ranging layoffs among civil servants. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports the specter of widespread cuts across the federal workforce is raising legal questions.
The Trump administration sent an email to federal workers this week offering them deferred resignations and warning those who choose to stay that they may be laid off or reassigned. Jed Sugarman, a law professor at Boston University, says how layoffs on such a large scale would work is unclear, both logistically and legally.
These are against statutes and against the Constitution, and this is part of the unitary executive myth of presidential power.
According to the Pew Research Center, the federal government employs more than 3 million civil servants, and that number hasn't changed much since 1970. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Recovery efforts continue at the Potomac River, where a passenger plane collided with an Army helicopter while attempting to land at Ronald Reagan National Airport near Washington, D.C. All 67 people aboard the two aircraft are presumed dead. Divers have recovered the cockpit voice and the flight data recorders of the plane. Federal investigators say it may take months to determine what went wrong. This is NPR News. Among those killed in the crash was a 26-year-old woman from Indiana, Azra Hussein. Ethan Sandweiss from member station WFIU spoke with her husband.
Raised in Carmel, Indiana, Azra Hussein worked as a healthcare consultant. Her husband, Hamid Raza, said she had a vision to reform healthcare in America, and he feels she had more to give.
She was returning from a work trip where she was helping to improve a hospital that really needed help, and she was doing what she loved. She was even working on the flight.
Hussein and Raza met through the Muslim Student Association at Indiana University. They were married 2.5 years. For NPR News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
Three members of the Canadian cabinet are in Washington today, meeting with Republican lawmakers and members of the Trump administration. They're urging President Trump not to impose a 25% tariff on Canadian goods, which he has said he'll do as early as tomorrow if Canada doesn't do more to stop the flow of drugs and migrants without legal status into the U.S. Trump has issued a similar warning to Mexico. The tariffs could blow up the trade agreement that Trump himself had negotiated in his first term. The Commerce Department reported this morning consumer prices rose 2.6% last month from the year before. The inflation gauge comes 2 days after the Federal Reserve decided to pause cutting interest rates. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The National Transportation Safety Board has launched its investigation into Wednesday night's mid-air collision near Washington's Reagan National Airport. Here's board member Todd Inman at a briefing yesterday.
We will not be determining the probable cause of the accident while we are here on scene, nor will we speculate about what may have caused this accident.
President Trump, meanwhile, blamed diversity and inclusion programs. NPR's Frank Morris reports on the reaction from the flight's city of origin, Wichita, Kansas.
Just as President Trump was offering an ideological explanation for the worst U.S. air traffic disaster in decades, hundreds of people were gathering at City Hall in Wichita to mourn.
I feel like even just being in this town, you can kind of feel like heartbreak just all around you. It's just very sad.
Megan Emery drove 2 hours from Manhattan, Kansas.
I know a lot of people from around the state who have come to show their support. I think it's beautiful.
Jay Tanui and Gata Reddy turned out for their neighbors.
I don't know any of the victims, but, you know, they come from here. We got to pray with them.
It's amazing. We're all a family together is what I feel.
That feeling seems pretty widespread in Wichita. Mayor Lily Wu says the big, diverse interfaith prayer service in and outside City Hall is a good example.
All faiths came together to offer prayers, thoughts, and truly comforting words for families who right now are still in a moment of distress and uncertainty. So it made me proud because in Wichita, we are united.
American Airlines Flight 5342 was important here before Wednesday night's tragedy. It's Wichita's only nonstop flight to D.C., literally celebrated in this city of 396,000. Bombardier, the company that made the airliner, recently moved its U.S. headquarters to Wichita. Leaders here are loath to assign a reason for the crash. Kansas Governor Laura Kelly says this is no time for speculation.
I think all of our attention ought to be focused right now on the families and the victims and leave the system issues and the causes to the folks who are trained very well to do this, and then come up with those answers and figure out exactly what went wrong.
And fix it so that something like Wednesday night's crash can't happen again. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Wichita.
Target once touted its commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion, a promise that seemed particularly important to a company headquartered in the city where the police killing of George Floyd set off a wave of protests around the world. But now, with DEI initiatives under attack by the Trump White House, the company, along with others, says it is winding down these programs, and that is prompting calls for a boycott from activists and influencers like Angela Artis.
I was a Target shopper, but I am not anymore. Until they reinstate that DEI program, I will not be shopping there. And I hope you don't too.
But some Black business owners who sell their products at Target say the move would hurt them the most. One of them is April Showers, founder and CEO of Afro Unicorn, a character-driven brand based around a Black unicorn. When you heard that these companies were winding down their DEI initiatives or whatever they called it, what do you think?
Initially, I wasn't that surprised, only because of the administration that we're under. I was disappointed, to say the least, but I had been disappointed for some time because I saw it winding down. I saw that the care for diversity, equity, and inclusion after George Floyd was really only around for a solid 18 months. So to hear these companies say that they were rolling back, I wasn't surprised, but I was disappointed, if that makes sense.
Have you seen any impact on your business of these, either the sort of call to wind down the DEI initiatives or these calls for a boycott? Have you seen any fall off in sales or any impact on your sales?
Not yet, but we're so early right now. Literally, I think a lot of the frustration too from the buyers is that the day that this came out, it was 1 day or 2 days before the set of the Black History Month program in Target. So these products just hit the floors this week.
As a vendor, as a supplier, you can't just boycott the retailer. Could you just say as briefly as you can why that's not so easy for you? Like for a consumer, you can just say, well, you know, I'm not going to buy that, or I'm not going to shop there. But as a vendor, you can't do that.
Well, I think what it is people are asking us to take our products out of the stores.
Right.
So that's the part that we cannot easily do. And we wouldn't want to just take our products out of the stores because there are thousands of people that walk these aisles every day. Our direct-to-consumer business does exist. But the eyeballs that we get by having your products in stores does not even compare.
Some of these companies made a really big deal out of their DEI initiatives. Is there any part of you that feels betrayed that now that they say they're winding them down or walking them back for whatever reason?
Not at all. I feel thankful for the opportunity. Giving me that shelf space is basically giving me another business. What I feel betrayed by are people saying that these products that I made for them, that they're not going to support them. That's the betrayal.
And because?
Because these products were made for them in mind. They were created because before there were no brown unicorns, you could not see yourselves in these particular products. And then you make these products, and then the ones that you make them with them in mind say that they're not going to support it. That's the betrayal.
Well, what do you say to people who say, look, these companies take a lot of our money. We are tired of being bullied by these companies. We want to be respected as consumers. And this is the only way that they can get their points across. I mean, look, one of the signature events of the civil rights movement was the Montgomery bus boycott. Boycotts have a storied history in American history and international events. And so what do you say to people who say this is a time-honored tactic?
And people can do what they want and purchase where they want to purchase. We're saying if you do want to purchase our product and you still want to support us in these retailer stores, you can walk into these stores and purchase our products only and walk out. Those numbers will still hurt.
So it is complicated.
It's very complicated. And I hate the fact that we are fighting about how to support Black businesses. We have a man in leadership who has this attack on words like diversity, equity, and inclusion. So many people are missing that. Why do people even care so strongly and passionately that we should not be diverse, there should not be equity, and there should not be any inclusion?
That is April Schauer. She's the founder and CEO of Afro Unicorn. It's a character-driven brand that sells like fashion and toys and puzzles and so forth, and she sells at Target and Walmart. April Schauer, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
This is NPR News.
We'll wrap up our week-long project on trash by asking, can we reduce mountains of garbage at the landfill by being more aware of what we buy? That's next time on Here and Now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. A baby shark was born in a habitat without any males earlier this month. Scientists aren't sure how that happened, since the two female sharks at Louisiana Shreveport Aquarium didn't have contact with males for more than 3 years. Aquarium officials say it could be due to delayed fertilization or a rare case of asexual reproduction. Either way, they say it's a testament that life will find a way. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin with A. Martinez. Federal employees have until February 6th to decide whether to voluntarily leave their jobs. The U.S. Office of Personnel Management, OPM, informed workers on Tuesday that if they hand in their resignation by next Thursday, that's less than a week from now, most will be allowed to take leave and be paid until the end of September. Michelle Berkovich is an employment lawyer who represents federal employees as a large part of her practice. So I asked her for her interpretation about what OPM's deferred resignation program would actually mean.
I actually don't consider it so much an offer. I think it's a request to resign with a vague promise that potentially you could be kept in administrative leave status for up to 8 months, but no guarantees.
Some people have been using the term buyout to describe what this is, because there seems to be the offer of administrative leave for up to 8 months if you take this offer. So is it a buyout?
I would absolutely not describe it as a buyout. I think that's a very misleading term to use in this situation. When you think of a buyout, there's usually some sort of written agreement or a concrete offer to provide a benefit in exchange for waiving certain rights. That is not the case here.
If clients ask you for your advice, what are you telling them?
First thing we tell them is exercise extreme caution. There are no guarantees contained in this email. The only thing I can tell you for certain is that if you change your mind, the agency is probably not going to let you withdraw that resignation, and you are essentially giving up control over a lot.
Is there some category of employee who you think this might benefit? Maybe they're close to retirement. Is somebody like that, might this be an attractive offer?
Folks near retirement need to be the most careful, because leaving earlier than intended can have serious consequences potentially on their benefits.
Let me just play a clip from the White House Press Secretary, Caroline Leavitt. She told reporters that this is a good deal for people who don't want to return to the office. Let me just play it.
This is a suggestion to federal workers that they have to return to work. And if they don't, then they have the option to resign. And this administration is very generously offering to pay them for 8 months.
You're shaking your head no.
In a way, it breaks my heart that federal employees are being jerked around like this. It sends a signal to me that this return to office order is in bad faith, but it's designed to get folks who work really hard to resign. I think it's trying to pull the wool over a lot of people's eyes, because there are no guarantees. And these are people who love their job. They love the mission of the agency. They work hard. And right now they're facing very hard choices, especially if they're remote. It's very coercive.
You say it's coercive because?
Essentially, if you're someone who lives in Oregon and has been told to report to D.C. or else we're going to fire you, they might feel that they have no choice than to take this option.
Do you anticipate legal challenges just to the offer itself? And if so, on what grounds?
This offer, to be honest, is so unprecedented that I think a lot of us are still trying to figure out what to do with it. I'm not sure if the offer itself may be challengeable. I think the bigger question is the execution of these terms. I'm not aware of any authority that exists right now for OPM to order agencies to give this number of people administrative leave. So I think it is very much possibly setting the stage for challenges, because I feel OPM has vastly exceeded their authority.
That is Michelle Berkovich. She is an employment lawyer with the Alden Law Group here in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you so much for having me here.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Before people who lost their homes in the Los Angeles wildfires can rebuild, they need money. But how does an insurance company figure out what a house is worth when there's nothing left standing? Nick Fountain from Planet Money's podcast has been looking into that.
Yeah, there's a job for that. Insurance adjusters, who work for insurance companies trying to do the seemingly impossible task of figuring out how much it's going to cost to rebuild a destroyed house and replace everything in it. It's a job that requires some pretty weird travel.
What disasters have you worked?
Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Ike, Hurricane Sandy, Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Odile. I'm trying to remember all the hurricanes. There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
I always forget some.
This is Leland Kuntz. He has 20 years of adjusting experience. I met him in Southern California while covering the fires.
So I just met this guy. He lost his house. He lost his business. Say you walk into his house.
As an insurance adjuster.
As an insurance adjuster.
Working for the insurance company.
Working for the insurance company. If it's totally destroyed, what do you do?
Okay. You need to try to create an estimate most of the time. So how do you write an estimate when it's burned to the ground? Well, for one thing, the concrete foundation is still there.
Like a detective, he's piecing together what used to be.
There's always clues in the debris. Like, I've looked at debris and ashes for so long, I can look at some little wires and say, well, that's a hairdryer.
But that only goes so far. So adjusters ask homeowners for a list of everything they had. Extra helpful, receipts and photos.
From birthdays and parties. When grandma came from Kansas City for Thanksgiving, she took some pictures of the kids. And yeah, it's a picture of the kid, but the sink is in the background.
Then, photo by photo, receipt by receipt, adjusters will add up everything. Every tile, every toilet, every TV that was in the house. And come up with a number. At least, that's how it works in theory. Kuhn says that insurers are not all that interested in the nitty-gritty details, the little line items. He says when he worked for them, the system incentivized him to clear cases fast.
Imagine if you're an executive insurance company. Do you have a big financial incentive to train the adjusters on how to do a sliding glass door correctly and add all the line items? A little bit, maybe. They want to be professional sometimes, but it's not like a main driver of their business.
If you are sensing a little skepticism towards the insurance industry from Kuntz, here's why. He doesn't work for an insurer anymore. He used to, but now he's what's called a public adjuster. If a homeowner feels the insurer's estimate is low, they can hire someone like Kuntz to give a second opinion.
There's a lot of money in the details.
Now, in a statement, the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies rejected the idea that insurers prioritize speed over accuracy, saying, quote, California requires insurers to handle claims timely as well as diligently. Public adjusters have no greater motivation for accuracy than anyone else. But public adjusters do have a pretty big motivation: money. They are paid a percentage of the new settlement, usually 10%, though it can be higher, which means sometimes they're a bad deal. California officials are warning fire victims about public adjusters who push their services, even in cases where they won't actually increase payouts after you account for their commission. Coons, for his part, says he really sweats the details and regularly gets his clients big payouts that more than pay for his fee. And yeah, if this dueling adjuster system seems like an inefficient way for people to get what they're owed from insurance companies, Coons doesn't disagree.
Is it a good system?
No. Very dysfunctional system. The things I'm describing to you, the neurotic level of detail, the mistrust on both sides, the average person can't figure it out and they get taken advantage of. I can come in and I'll be honest, I can make really good money by doing my part in this very dysfunctional system. I make my money off the dysfunctionality.
Coon says, yeah, these next few years might be pretty lucrative for him. Nick Fountain, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
Hey, A.
Yeah.
Ever bite into a yummy-looking apple only to be rewarded with a chunk of nasty, mealy pulp?
Oh, my God. If I expect crisp and instead get squish, it's a bad, bad deal.
It is a bad day.
Bad okay. deal.
Well, it turns out other creatures associate the texture of food with how tasty it is, too, like fruit fly larvae, a.k.a. Maggots. Here's science reporter Ari Daniel.
The persimmon was Nikita Komarov's favorite fruit when he was growing up in Moscow.
When they are properly ripe, they're delicious and sweet and soft.
Just before that, though, they're tart and bitter. He learned to tell from the first bite whether it'd be bliss or blah based on the texture of the fruit, even before he tasted anything. Komarov, who's a neurobiology PhD student at the University of Freiburg in Switzerland, says this sense of mouthfeel,
is it crunchy? Is it soft? Is it chewy? Is it gooey?
Gives important information about food safety and quality, helping avoid eating something that might be dangerous. But actually, very little is known about how animals perceive food texture. So Komarov and his colleagues turned to study the phenomenon in fruit flies, specifically the larva.
It eats constantly, so it really, really, really cares about food.
Komarov engineered larvae without their taste organ, while leaving everything else about them untouched.
We gave the animals a choice between a harder and a softer substrate.
Normal larvae prefer to eat the softer substrate, but the larvae without a taste organ ate both.
They suddenly stopped caring.
So Komarov suspected an intact taste organ also allows a larva to detect that delicious, not too hard, not too soft, rotting fruit texture, kind of like human tongues.
In the maggot, what was thought to be an exclusively taste organ is actually also a texture organ.
Texture, turns out, is as important a signal to the maggot as how bitter or toxic a food is. Komarov then examined one of the neurons within the taste organ. He found it responds to sugar, acid, salt, and texture.
Seems to be a neuron that sort of does a little bit of everything.
That is, not all neurons respond to just one thing and relay it up to the brain. It's way more complex. Komarov says the work may one day provide insights into eating disorders among people. And on the flip side, how to tweak the texture of foods, healthy or otherwise, to make them more palatable. The research is published in PLOS Biology. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.